Hey, so what are we talking about today anyway?
So, we know it's been a while. Welcome back. So today we're going to start off, we're going to take Story Trek down a little bit of a different tack. And this is hopefully the first in a series of a topic that we're going to go over. The point of this topic, I feel like, is a little bit of, you know, just making sure that there are no sacred cows. I think Star Trek is probably famous more than anything else, more than Shatner, more than they travel through space, than it is. It's more famous for being one of the most decidedly progressive shows in the history of television. And yet there are sometimes when they don't hit the mark. As we discuss Story Trek, I think that that's worth it to discuss that. But the one episode that I wanted to bring up for the beginning of a series that we will probably call, or maybe we'll retitle it, but we've been calling it Problematic Trek. We're going to start off, you know, just jump into the deep end with probably one of the most infamously problematic episodes of all time, Star Trek The Next Generation, Season 1, Episode 3, Code of Honor.
Is it Episode 3? I thought it's right after the pilots, and the pilot's considered one, right?
I thought the pilot is considered one, and then there's The Naked Now,
mm-hmm.
and then there's Code of Honor.
Got it. So basically we had the DC Fontana, Gene Roddenberry penned 2-hour pilot. And then we had a rehash of The Naked Time in The Naked Now. And then we got this.
And boy, is it a doozy.
You know, when you think about Star Trek up to that point, this probably would have felt like some people having flashbacks in 1969 to the third season of TOS. Like the last time you'd seen anything like that was what, Savage Curtain?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of criticisms to make about Code of Honor, and we're going to make them. But I think the most damning criticism of it is it's just a bad story. I rewatched it, obviously, for this episode, and it's so bad that you lose focus and attention on what's going on, even when you're intending to watch it.
Yeah, the racist undertones, overtures, however you'd like to describe it, under or over, and the misogyny in the episode is quite palpable.
Now, to be fair, 100%, we could do an entire separate podcast that's just called Misogyny Trek.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think you and I are qualified to host that podcast, but there's enough grist for the mill for at least a season of content. But Trek is famous for trying, at the very least, to be racially progressive. Now, they may stumble here and there, but this is the first time that they've ever really just thrown it out there. But I think the most interesting thing about this episode in terms of Story Trek is that if you purely read the script for this episode, no imagery whatsoever, there's misogyny, definitely. Yeah, that's there. But there's hardly any racism in it. So this is a unique opportunity to show how storytelling, especially in visual media, television, film, is not just about the script. There's an whole army of people who, in their specific respective arts, are also storytellers and contributing to the larger story. Now, the story of Code of Honor and the production of it, the culprit, if you're looking for one, appears to be the director of the episode, Russ Mayberry.
And I believe that Russ never directed for any Star Trek ever again.
According to my research, he was fired in the middle of this episode. And I think Gene and maybe another producer took over. From what I gather, essentially, Russ Mayberry is the one who decided to cast all African-American actors in the roles of these aliens. And these aliens are, the intention from my research was that they are a society that's more akin to a samurai culture, Japanese culture, not racially Japanese, but culturally following the code of Bushido or something, an alien equivalent of it. And this code would drive one of them, the leader of them, to engage in some misogynistic shenanigans to try and kill his wife. So he takes control of the whole planet and all of her money, and it backfires. And the plot, you don't really need to care. The point is that if you read the script, there's not a whole lot, but the specifically director, Russ Mayberry, hired mostly African-American actors. According to a podcast or a comment by Will Wheaton, Will even though he was young at the time, he was under the impression that the director, Russ Mayberry, was fired not for his casting choices, but specifically for being racially insensitive to the actors he had cast in those roles. So there's a lot going on here, as you can see, and we're going to get to the storytelling aspects of it in a second. But it's worth it to talk about the production and how, you know, one key figure. But I felt like while watching this, there was more to the racism than that. Now, obviously, Russ Mayberry's director has a lot of creative control over the vision and the thrust of what that episode is going to be and how it's going to go. Now, my question is, how much of that, you know, influenced some of the other aspects of it? As I'm watching the episode, I noticed every male has a scarification, you know, some sort of a tribal scar. They're all wearing these, the best I could describe is sub-equatorial clothing. Star Trek, often when they would take from a culture, just to make sure that you're not drawing too close of a connection between this culture and villainy or something like that, what they would do is that they would flip things so that you don't have the exact one-to-one of a specific culture. This is the first time you have an exact one-to-one of a specific culture. And it's jarring how casual it is. And yet at the same time, you feel like as you watch it, some of the actors are extremely uncomfortable. But I'm sort of rambling because there's a lot to get to here.
It's a standalone episode of Star Trek that in many ways, it also begs the question, you're trying to launch a new show. You're trying to get your best scripts out there, get your scripts shot as soon as possible to get it on the air. You got 26 episodes to do in a season at that time. And it's typical that bad episodes get buried somewhere in the middle of a season or towards later part of the season. It's pretty rare that something like this pops up this early in a show, especially one that has sustained run like it did. How much did the creators of this show know it was off the rails before it was filmed?
I have to admit, when I looked up this episode to watch it, I was absolutely surprised that it was the third episode of the first season. The funny thing about it is that it isn't in your face racism. You know, it's this 1940s, 1950s patronizing, gentle, as such as you can call a gentle racism to a certain extent. You know, so it doesn't really, you know, violently offend you. It just makes you extremely uncomfortable to watch it. And you have to feel for those actors who were watching it. But again, I think that what's fascinating about this one is that this is a part of the story that does not exist in the script. This is a directorial choice in casting and also costuming. And again, I can't imagine that the single scar that each male has is an accident. So as you go through the course of the story, you see that, again, there are a lot of parallels between the way African-American actors or actors of African-American descent were treated in films in the 1940s and 1950s. There's a lot of exaggerated performances. There's a lot of, you know, bright smiles and deep voices and things like that. Who do you blame? You know, who do you blame? The costumers? Do you blame the makeup people? Do you blame just the director? Do you blame the producers? Where does the creative control lie for something like that?
In the end, I mean, to me, the buck stops at the showrunner. And at the time, and this is probably indicative of it, even though Gene Roddenberry's name is on it and he was heavily involved, there's also a lot of reports that at the same time wasn't exactly all there. It's not really clear who the hell was in charge. It's strange to me that no one in costuming or casting started to raise a flag. And if there did and nothing was said, I'm curious who ignored those flags that were raised. Who was there listening to these flags being raised?
So to bring up just a few facts that I pulled up, according to a few reports, and I can cite sources, according to an interview with Keith Candido from Tor.com, this is from, looks like 2013, the African theme of the episode was brought in by director Russ Mayberry, who had the Ligonians, the alien race who are guest starring in the episode, cast entirely from African-American actors. Mayberry was fired during production by the show's creator, Gene Roddenberry, and first assistant director, Les Landau, completed the episode.
So, I mean, Roddenberry knew. He knew enough.
He knew enough.
What I do recall from the time, and I haven't seen any sources to verify this, is I recall watching the pilot Encounter at Farpoint when it came out. And I remember there being, I tuned in at around the same time that the show was supposed to air the following week for the second episode. And I got The Naked Now. And then the next week, I got another episode. It's escaping me which one it would have been. Not The Last Outpost. It would have been...
I can look up the list. Hold on.
Yeah.
So Code of Honor is considered the fourth overall episode. The previous one before that is The Naked Now. And then I guess technically on this is considering Encounter and Farpoint as two episodes. I'll just go ahead and count that as one. So Code of Honor is episode three.
Okay.
Our next episode is The Last Outpost.
Last Outpost.
Yeah.
Okay. So I got it. So yeah, remember The Last Outpost coming. And then you had where no man has gone, or no one has gone before, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Or you had where silence has lease. Lonely Among Us, right?
Yes.
My point is that I never remember seeing in its initial run Code of Honor. Not for any reason of, oh, I didn't tune in. I remember vividly watching each and every episode. And at the time, I believe Channel 39 in Houston aired both the episode on Saturday and Sunday, if I recall. Am I mistaken?
I remember that, yes.
Okay. It was like different times, but they'd air them on both days. And it wasn't until the summer reruns that I saw Code of Honor. And I remember going like, oh, new episode. Holy crap. You know?
Right.
I thought there was a rerun. Oh, they snuck one in. And then there was Code of Honor. And I was like, wait, Tasha Yar's in it? She died. Like, I was like, what's going on here? The last episode I had seen before that was The Neutral Zone. Tasha Yar is dead. I was waiting for the moment that they were going to connect to what happened the previous week and why Tasha Yar is suddenly there. So I had no understanding whatsoever that this episode existed until reruns. And I wonder if at some level the show had pushed that Code of Honor not air in some markets, at least, in its initial syndication run.
That's an interesting question. And it's entirely plausible if you keep in mind the fight that Gene had over syndication markets with the interracial kiss on Star Trek in the 1960s.
I mean, there's a lot of instances where, especially in syndication, where a show will air in one market and not another. I also remember that I didn't see it until that summer because I remember just being so caught off guard by seeing Tasha. Like, I remember seeing like a rerun, and at the end of the rerun, it shows you next time on Star Trek. And there's Tasha Yar. And I was like, wait, what? I have to see this. I mean, the show is, it's not as if it's been removed from the history of Trek, but at the same time, it sits there very oddly among the pantheon of Trek episodes, and one that is emblematic of the utter disregard in Hollywood for so long with racial sensitivity. And so you could argue, of course, even today, there's a lot of different issues as well. It's a weird outlier within the Star Trek universe that it would be that blatantly off.
It's one of the few Star Trek shows that most fans universally agree on is pretty bad, including the cast. According to Michelle Erica Green, Trek Nation from 2007, Jonathan Frakes and including other cast members sought to prevent the episode from being re-aired. In an interview with Entertainment Weekly in 2012, Patrick Stewart agreed with fans that considered season two, Measure of a Man, to be the first truly great episode. And he said that the first season, quote, had several quite weak episodes. Referring to Code of Honor in particular, he said, I can think of one very early on that involved a race of black aliens that we all felt quite embarrassed about. And when I read that and I looked at how the actors were performing on the show, you do really get this sense that Patrick Stewart is absolutely embarrassed by this.
Oh, yeah. It really does read as if everyone was just like, okay.
Yeah. I think it's fascinating that everybody recognized, and to its credit, again, let's not be too woke. This is 1987. Yes, people recognize that was a problem. There's not likely a human resources infrastructure mm-hmm. on productions in 1987, 1988, as you may have nowadays, especially. And yet at the same time, despite that, this guy got fired in the middle of the episode. So you can look at it as this was so egregious that was something that nobody could stand at the time. Or you can look at it that we are somewhat evolved. We're not quite as bad as we think we are. And when the face of obvious racism, people will say something. But I can totally understand that that episode just couldn't be salvaged. You have a budget. It's like, well, we've come this far. We have to finish the damn thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's the first season of a show. They don't have the luxury of being able to scrap episodes.
Right.
I imagine syndication, just like network TV, you have contracts that say you deliver this many episodes in a season. I'm assuming that's the primary, if not sole reason, that this episode actually made it out the doors, except maybe on like some like bootleg VHS tape, some fan got a hold of an unreleased episode of Star Trek.
I mean, you have to admit, if any episode deserves to be the lost episode, it's this one.
I mean, it's the one that I always tell people whenever they're going to watch The Next Generation for the first time. I'm like, watch the pilot and you can watch Naked now. That's cool. And then you should skip Code of Honor. Well, what's wrong with Code of Honor? I'm like, just skip it.
Yeah.
And invariably, what happens is somebody has a curiosity, hit play on the streaming, right? And then we start mm-hmm. watching it. And then I get a text message or whatever. It says, oh, wow, I see why you were talking about. I'm skipping this one.
Guys.
You know, and I almost wonder, like, how many people had tuned in to watch Trek for the first time or one of the first times, and that was what they were welcomed with.
That's a stunning idea, you know, and you have to wonder also, you know, how many people, you know, in markets where it was first run and it was literally the, you know, for a third episode, you know, how many people around the country saw that and said, what the hell? Is this, what are they doing with Star Trek now?
That, or if you're not a fan and you were just tuning in and you're just like, I wonder what the Star Trek thing is about.
Yeah, that's your first introduction. Wonderful. You see aliens that basically have traveled out of some Safari Explorer movie from 1947.
I wonder if any of the actors that were principled, that played the Lugonians, were ever brought back to Trek to actually act separate from playing this awful characters that they were subjected to play.
That's an interesting question.
Yeah, I'd love to know. Did you ever like consider hiring these people in roles that weren't like racially charged?
Right. And it makes it all the more interesting because it's not very many years after this where you have Deep Space Nine starring Avery Brooks as Captain Sisko, the first African-American or person of color really to be the lead of a Star Trek show. The fandom's lack of embrace of Sisko, there are a lot of factors in that go into it. And, you know, keeping in with the theme, comedy comes in threes, you could do a whole separate podcast with its own subject, fandom and Trek. And there's enough grist for that mill. We won't get into that right now. But at the same time, I think that there are a lot of factors that have kind of prevented people from embracing Sisko. That said, I think a lot of people have begun to embrace him a lot more, especially than they did in the 90s or the 2000s, I think. The initial draw is that this is the show with Star Trek's first African-American captain. And so you say, oh, cool. Okay, cool. I want to see that. I think that for a lot of people, the detractors are Deep Space Nine is not this bright, cheerful show. It's a lot more philosophical and thoughtful and pensive. And so that can be, you know, when you're used to The Next Generation and the original series, that's a kind of a different pace. Mm-hmm. At the same time, also, there's the moral complexity of it. You know, there are episodes where Sisko commits literal war crimes, objectively speaking, but he does so for the greater good. And so a lot of people are used to their captains being a little bit more Sir Patrick Stewart, a little bit more your moral grandfather, or moral father, so to speak, that sort of an aspect. Sisko came in as a completely different being altogether. And it is, he's going to do what needs to be done. I think that a lot of people can appreciate that more now as we have more television series where your lead characters have shades of gray.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the question I have with television today and why I think Deep Space Nine is a little bit more, has a little bit more cachet Is it because of streaming? Is it because people can now sit down and watch Deep Space Nine and see this overarching storyline, can see that this wasn't just a one-off episode every week like you had before or after? And I mean, it is such a black sheep, if you will, of Star Trek. You've never had Trek before where it was like on a space station. Like everything that's fundamental to the setting of Star Trek was shifted a little bit. And it hasn't been shifted in that way since either. I mean, the fact that the Sisko is a commander, not a captain. Okay. Well, tomato, tomato. I mean, he's still in charge, right? Well, it's the extra pip on his collar.
Right.
So we hadn't seen that before. And up until Discovery, we hadn't seen it since. We're not on a starship. We're not in a situation where everybody is Starfleet. Half the main cast is non-Starfleet. If you want to get technical, you could say Wesley Crusher was the first non-Starfleet. But really,
true.
The whole show, it's the first time we've seen non-Starfleet in lead roles. And I can't think of any Trek that even did that until Picard. And that's ex-Starfleet in that case. But it took so many risks for its time and stories. And yet at the same time, it doesn't have an episode like Code of Honor.
Right. And to be fair, they're one episode that can compete in terms of compete. Or it's a race for the bottom. Is, I think it's called All the Way Home.
There is that one. Yeah, but that one's pretty bad. There is another one that's very misogynistic. And I was just watching it the other day, actually.
So this is an episode where Quark, it literally begins with Quark propositioning an employee of his at the bar for sex in exchange for a promotion. The plot basically involves a version of Tootsie, where Quark, for convoluted reasons, has to appear to be a Ferengi woman in order to secure some sort of business deal. And by appearing to be a woman, he learns that treating women like non-humans he's not human, or human, as you might say, treating women as non-equals is hurtful. And, you know, again, I don't think two guys are qualified to really dissect this episode, but if you have an opportunity to watch it, I invite any of our women out there who are listeners, please let us know how you feel about that. And we'd love to hear your comments on it, because we think that there are some problems there, and we'd love to hear what you say are the problems as well.
Yeah, there's a little red alert going on in the back of my head on that.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, though, that we were talking, as we were discussing the topic of this episode off the mic, if you will, one of the things that occurred to me in sort of this problematic Trek world is that Code of Honor, they're aliens, quote unquote, and we're seeing them through the lens of these racist tropes that are put forward. And the question is, how many times does Star Trek not put forward an alien race that's clearly alien? There's not a question of like, uh-oh, they're doing something like they did with Code of Honor. They put these alien races forward, but then they treat them in a very casually racist way. I think there's no bigger example of it, of sort of like, you know, alien racism in Star Trek, than if you look at anything from how Spock and McCoy banter in the original series to The Undiscovered Country.
There was a time when I was a young man, and as I was watching some of the original series episodes,
I thought you were still a young man.
Thank you. I was watching some of the original series episodes, and yeah, and when I looked at it and realized that McCoy was from Mississippi, the amount of racist banter he gave to Spock, I thought that was maybe like a subversive code to a certain extent. I now obviously realize it wasn't. It was just them, quote unquote, good-naturedly ribbing one of the few crew members who's not like them in the entire ship, or ostensibly the only crew member who wasn't human on the entire Enterprise.
Yeah. What's fascinating about it to me is that it became something that the writers were like, hey, we can write this stuff and people actually respond positively to it. And I mean, I guess it brings up all kinds of moral and philosophical questions of, you know, how people respond to casual racism when it's put forward in a quote unquote funny way. You're sitting there going, okay, clearly Leonard Nimoy is, you know, a human being, not a Vulcan. But the way he's being treated is the same way we would look very harshly if he was of a race of human beings, non-white.
It's very fascinating when you think about it that way. If you had that sort of banter, you know, about a fictional race, and it was not played as anything that was negative, if you had that sort of a scene in, you know, debut in our modern day currently, would you have fans literally backlash against that? You know, would you have people saying that's racist, even though you're aware you're talking about a fictional race? Are we now so aware of racism and its practices that we react to the practice, even if it doesn't matter if the race exists or not?
Well, I think the Trek did evolve slightly with regards to this, because in the 1980s, you recall Dr. Crusher left for season two. Right. And then they brought in Dr. Pulaski, who suddenly was, the whole idea was to bring back the Dr. McCoy Spock thing between her and Data. And she constantly reminds Data that he's an artificial life form, or he has no feelings and all this kind of stuff. And the show was trying to play it for the same type of, you know, fan pleasure, if you will, that they received out of the McCoy and Spock stuff. And this time the fans actually reacted very badly to it. And my question is, and again, this is probably more complicated and don't really have an answer, but it's something to think about. Were people backlashing to the Pulaski Data thing because it had these sort of racist undertones in the way that she was treating him? Or was it the fact that there was people backlashing to the fact that that they didn't like Dr. Pulaski as a woman?
That's a fascinating question. Just to take a minute to mind walk it. Again, you know, you do have this, because even watching it, you know, independently of anything, you look at it as like, damn, that's just really mean spirited. You know, you don't even have to look at any of the racist subtext. You can literally just feel that it's mean spirited and it doesn't appear to be at all playful. And yet that totally worked for DeForest Kelly. So I do think that there's a little bit of, I don't know if this is a bias of mine or if it's a bias of the general public or if I just didn't like the delivery or whatever it may be. But there is a sense that, you know, you cannot be, you know, if you're a fictional character and you're a woman, if you have what we may call rough edges, then you have to be a villainess. You know, you can't be the Bones McCoy sort of surly, grouchy person with a heart of gold. There are female tropes that exist like that, but that's typically more of the matron side, right? That's the older woman, or maybe I may be digging myself into a hole here. But the point is that there is this sort of backlash against the idea of women being anything other than agreeable people. So I do think that that may have had something to do with the reaction people had to Dr. Pulaski. And again, the dialogue just sounds mean-spirited. I don't know if DeForest Kelly had some way of phrasing it that didn't make it sound so bad. You know, again, it was a whole different animal, or the audience simply evolved and was able to recognize that, yeah, that's not okay. That's just really mean-spirited. And you're lucky that you're doing it to someone who doesn't have emotions.
One other thing that I was thinking about is that when you look at the McCoy and Spock relationship, Spock didn't just, like Data, sit there and listen to these things said to him. Spock had his own witty banter back, his own comebacks, if you will, against McCoy, whereas Data sat there and sort of took it.
Right. So it felt a little bit like, you know, kicking a puppy when you're hurting Data, because he understands that he's being insulted. He just doesn't care.
Doesn't register. Doesn't affect him. Whereas at some level, Spock took some sort of, if you will, Vulcan delight in his pride of not being what McCoy is.
And to be fair, Spock on moments displayed a little bit of racism against humans.
Yep.
Now, it always felt like a little bit justified because, again, he's an alien amongst humans. But of course, he did feel Vulcan superior to humans and things like that. So there wasn't, I think generally the issue there with the original series is just the uncomfortable comfort that everybody had with just trading these, you know, offensive, culturally offensive, racially offensive barbs at each other. And again, we could do an entire episode strictly on the Savage Curtain. That's a long story. If we're talking about problematic Trek, we can do an entire whole episode just based solely on that. You're welcome to watch it if you dare.
I think there's very few episodes out of the third season that stand out as beacons of Trek, not only in the writing and quality of the show from a story Trek perspective of, hey, this is a great episode we should talk about, and probably even less so ones that don't just go, oh dear. Like, you know, one of the things I've heard people bring up before is, like, if you look at even Plato's Stepchildren, you know, the one that's highly regarded for the first interracial kiss, or one of the first interracial kisses on television. And at the same time, a scene, if I'm not mistaken, like 2 minutes later after the kiss, if that, where you've got Spock using a bullwhip.
Right. I forgot about that.
Popping it at Nurse Chapel, if I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
It's, you know, there's some weird things going on. I don't think, unlike some other shows at the time, it seems very tone deaf to have at one moment a landmark or one of the landmark moments in television, and then turn around and have something that's utterly disgusting and problematic in itself.
Right.
It begs to question that it can't be, I would imagine, anything more than you have a show run by white men in the 1960s.
Yeah. It's a jarring dichotomy, and it's one of the interesting, fascinating things about Star Trek. And again, how do these things go together, and how does it affect story? The story always is a part of something larger, or it should be, if you're telling a great story or something that matters, and Star Trek is all about that. When Star Trek is telling stories about race specifically, of course, they're on the side of right, and you always have these little moments, with the exception of Code of Honor, which is an entire damned episode. But you always have these little moments of stumbling, which is why I felt like Code of Honor is a fascinating look at a whole episode where Star Trek just failed.
The moment it goes off the rails, clearly there was some push. There was something that happened in firing the director. That there's something that happened in the way the performances came across in the end. There's something that happened with the way the actors have always talked about that episode. It's interesting to see at what point people realize or come to realize things as being problematic. And how much of things that we look at today in the lens of 2021, looking back at it, do we see as problematic that they would have looked at and gone, that's strange. Anyway.
Right.
You were talking earlier, and I was reminded of this, when you were talking about Captain Sisko, Commander Sisko, Benjamin Sisko, the emissary, that he was a character who had to deal with a lot of gray areas. To me, a lot of that had to do with not that he was the first captain to have to deal with it. Picard goes to a planet, messes with their culture, tells them that their god is a lie. Kirk did the same thing. We never see the blowback of these actions because it's always at the end of the episode, three to beam up. We don't really grasp what's going to happen next. We never get that. With Deep Space Nine, because we're set in a certain place, because we have certain recurring characters, stuff can't just be brushed under the rug. Now, granted, Deep Space Nine does brush things under the rug, unfortunately, including,
yes,
like O'Brien's PTSD.
That man needs years of therapy.
Up until we got to Lower Decks, an animated series, did we actually talk about blowback? We actually addressed blowback from all of these adventures that Kirk had had. And, you know, it's the first time Trek is looking at this blowback issue. And I digress, but my point is that Sisko was put on an island of being the first captain that actually we witnessed have to deal with the blowback. And in fact, the only other time I would even argue that we saw any of that was Kirk in Wrath of Khan.
So just to piggyback on what you were saying there, with Deep Space Nine, I had never seen, I noticed so many people get called out or cursed out by their boss in a show, whether Sisko is cursing out people, or, you know, whether it's Odo or Kira or admirals are cursing him out. And so the idea is that everybody's held accountable. So the consequences in the show aren't necessarily big, major consequences like this thing you did episodes ago comes back to haunt you. It's, hey, you're not supposed to do that. you know, it's something that we rarely ever saw in the Next Generation or in the original series, but you see it much more often in Deep Space Nine, and it kind of gives and feeds this authenticity that the show has.
And I guess in that, going back to what we originally started with on that about accountability, it's there's that accountability on screen, but what about the accountability off screen with choice of casting and directing, direction and makeup, etc.?
I think the perfect words to kind of sum up are some recent words. Actually, LeVar Burton, he appeared on a Canadian talk show, George Strombolopoulos tonight. Mm-hmm. But he gave some of his comments and about his view of, you know, the working with Gene and on Star Trek. He says, "I was and still am a huge science fiction fan. In Gene's vision, there was a place for me, and that meant a lot." And he goes on to say, "Gene was very contradictory in nature. He was this visionary and he loved his booze, and nothing pleased him more than seeing a woman in a short skirt. So I really had to recognize that in addition to being this wonderful visionary, he was still a guy. He was a man. And we've all got faults. We've all got foibles. And the best thing we can do is wake up every morning and, in spite of our mistakes, go up and get up and go out there and do it all over again."
Unfortunately, Gene's not around today to defend himself or not defend himself. In what I've read of him, he's a person who's very well aware of his faults, but did very little to correct them. It was interesting that on one hand, you had this very sexist overtures in his concepts, and then he also turned around and employed a number of women TV writers in the 60s. You know, even brought back Dorothy Fontana to co-write Encounter at Farpoint with him, and was on the same staff until she decided to leave because of obviously all the chaos going on. And, you know, I've heard things like, you know, Nichelle Nichols having very good things to say about him, and same thing with Grace Lee Whitney, even though her departure from the original series had to deal with another producer, apparently. It's just the contradictory nature of human beings to see on display here. Someone who's, you look at all the things that he writes about racism and xenophobia in America and interventionism overseas and the role of capitalism in society and all this stuff. Then he hires some women, but then he puts them in short skirts. It's a product of its era. And that's in the end, the only thing you can say. I think it's just better to understand that that was what it was and that contradiction existed.
That plus, I think the only other thing I would add is that Star Trek has always been aspirational progressively. You know, it's never presumed that even in its time in the present, you know, its fictional future, it never presumed that it was perfect, simply improved. So in every single show, there's a moment where every single character has to say, yeah, we can do better. And so I think that that was always interesting about Trek. It never placed itself too high on a pedestal and never said that, you know, we are progressively perfect or we're as woke as we can be. We're more woke than anybody. It was always aspirational and always from a perspective of, look at how far we've come. Look at how much further we could go.
And to its credit, I think Star Trek has gone a lot further. In fact, I just saw the casting for Strange New Worlds. They rounded out the full cast for the show. And obviously, there's not much information, or at least available, about the show at this time, other than what we know, that it's the Enterprise and that it's Spock and Pike and Number One. I mean, that's really all we know. We don't know who these other characters really are, if they're cast members, you know, portraying characters from the original pilot, or are they altogether new characters? I imagine it's probably almost all new. Star Trek didn't just stop with introducing Blue DeBarrio as a non-binary character. We moved forward and see now that we have a transgender woman cast in a leading role on Strange New Worlds.
That's incredible. That's, you know, great.
That's what's going on screen. And then behind the camera, we see that Star Trek has had a diverse set of voices represented in writing the show. As we talk about the show further, There's certainly some things that we could critique about the writing on different shows of different eras, but it's very clear that the representation in the writing room has changed considerably from the days of Code of Honor.
I honestly wonder if you could take some of the TNG era writers, or even Gene himself, and give him a glimpse of the writer's room and what it looks like for Discovery or Strange New Worlds or Picard or the production directing crew. It'd be interesting. I think that everyone involved would be extremely pleased that there is that much diversity on a Star Trek show. And I think that they would say that's what it should have been all along. Mm-hmm. Just my two cents.
Story Trek is still probably brought to you by nobody. Please try to like and subscribe to our podcast if you're listening to it on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcasting platform. You can follow us on Twitter. I believe it's story_trek. And I believe Facebook, we have a page as well, Marshall.
We do now have a Facebook page. That page is at StoryTrekMM. M as in mouse or M as in Michael, M as in Marshall.
All right. Well, thank everybody for listening to us once again.
I'm Marshall Hopkins.
And I'm Michael Sturdygakis. Until next time.